She sees Scarlett's hand go to her neck to cover a mark. She sees that under her pyjama top she is braless. She looks at Liam, who eyes her strangely before saying, "Nice to meet you." He has bare feet, and his shoes are nowhere to be seen. "Liam came over last night," Scarlett says, her hand still clutching her neck. "I was having a freak out and my mum was out. He decided, well, we...
It was me, really,"
Liam chips in. "I decided to stay over, because we'd had a bit to drink."
"Yes, it was safer, so he stayed."
"Yes, I stayed. And now," he says, "I'm going. If only I could remember where I put my shoes."
He starts to wander about the hallway, hunting for his shoes, and Tallulah looks at Scarlett.
"What the hell?"
Tallulah whispers. Scarlett shrugs.
"I'm not allowed to call you, so I called him."
Tallulah peels Scarlett's fingers away from her neck and sees the telltale grey-red greys of a love bite. Scarlett's fingers snap straight back to the spot.
"It was a messy night," she says. "We didn't have sex, we just, you know."
Tallulah opens her mouth to say something, but seeing Liam reappear clutching a pair of brown leather hiking boots, she closes it again. She feels tears pulsing through her sinuses. She wants to cry, and she wants to be sick. They stand in silence until Liam has laced up his boots and is ready to leave. She watches him lean in to kiss Scarlett briefly on her cheek. Scarlett clears her throat and smiles tightly and says,
"Thanks for coming. You're a star."
"Bye, Tallulah," he says. "Lovely to meet you."
"Yes,"
she says in a tight, high voice.
"You too."
And then he is gone, and it is just her and Scarlett in the hallway. Scarlett comes towards her to touch her, and Tallulah flinches. Scarlett tuts.
"I swear," she says, "it was nothing. It was just, you know, he's Liam, me and him. We've got history, and I drank far too much, and it was just silly, you know, mucking about."
Tallulah can't think of any words. She stands with her arms folded, and she glares at the floor.
"I mean, come on, Tallulah. You aren't really in a position to judge. You live with your fucking boyfriend. And don't tell me you don't have sex with him, because I know you do."
Tallulah thinks of the snatched moments she offers up to Zach because she knows that if they can get it out of the way, he won't ask her at a moment that's even worse. She'll say,
"Come on, Mum's taking Noah to the pond. We've got 5 minutes, but be quick."
And then he would be quick, and she could buy herself another 2 weeks of him not pestering her, of not having to think about it. So yes, they have sex, but no, it is nothing compared to the Sunday mornings that she and Scarlett spend in Scarlett's king-size bed on her 800 thread count cotton sheets. Nothing whatsoever.
"That's not the same," she says.
"Of course it's the same. It's comfort, it's habit. It's a way to keep them on side because we need to keep them on side."
"Whoa."
"Whoa what? Come on, Lules. You know it's true.
You're Zach. What is he for? What is it he gives you which means you won't end your relationship with him? That you still sleep with him? There has to be something."
"There's nothing," she says. "Zach doesn't give me anything."
"So why do you want to stay with him?"
"I don't want to," Tallulah says. "I want to leave him. But we've been together since we were children. He's the only man I've ever..."
She stops briefly as tears come to her eyes.
"I sleep with him because I have to. For reasons you could never begin to imagine. But what about you? You didn't have to do whatever you did last night with Liam. You're not in a relationship with him. He knows you don't love him. It's over, so why?"
Scarlett sighs and throws Tallulah an infuriatingly gentle look.
"Just because."
"Because?
Look, I'm not really... I mean, I can prioritise people, but never entirely limit them."
"Limit them?"
"Yeah, so, like, you're my priority. You are 100% the most important person in my life. Like, ever, probably. But that doesn't mean there won't be other people in my life who aren't as important as you, who I don't feel about the way I feel about you, but who are there and who I am not going to get rid of."
"You mean you don't do monogamy?"
"I guess, if you want to put it that way. But honestly, please, just forget about that.
She gestures at the front door. Let's start over. Come on. There's pecan danishes in the kitchen. They're from yesterday, but they're still really, really good.
Please, I've missed you so much.
The thought of sitting on the blue sofa in Scarlett's huge glass kitchen and licking the icing off a pecan danish under a furry blanket and then finding the angles of Scarlett's body in her bedroom and sitting together with the dog afterwards discussing which bits of him they like the best feels like all she wants in the whole world. But that's not what she came here to do. She'd come to hand herself to Scarlett, all 100% of herself. And now she knows that she will never have 100% of Scarlett, that Scarlett will always have intimate gaps and spaces where other people fit in, and that is not what she wants for herself, or for Noah, or for her future. And then she realizes that she has never been more than an experience for Scarlett, just as Liam had been. An experiment, a thing to do to try and decide if she likes it or not, so that one day she can tell whoever she decides she wants to spend her life with that when she was young, she tried out a posh farmer boy with a penchant for zip-neck jumpers, and then when she tired of that, she tried out a village girl from a cul-de-sac who was training to be a social worker, and that after her there would be someone or something else. So she looks at Scarlett with tear-filled eyes and says,
No. I'm going home. Forget it. Forget this. I'm worth more.
She slams Scarlett's door behind her and mounts her bike, cycles hard all the way home, her eyes blinded with tears, thinking of her last words to Scarlett and wondering if they were even true. Chapter 34, September 2018. Sophie meets Jacinta Croft in a small wine bar around the corner from Victoria Station at 6 p.m. She has messages from Sean on her phone asking where she is. She's about to reply to them when she looks up and sees Jacinta approaching.
I can't stay long, Jacinta says, detaching a huge leather bag from her shoulder and resting it on the table in front of her.
Me neither, says Sophie. My train goes in 30 minutes.
Good, well then, let's get some wine, pronto.
She calls over a waitress and orders two small glasses of something French without asking Sophie if that's what she'd like, and then she turns to face her and says,
So, Susie Beats, I googled you after you left. Something about you didn't quite stack up.
Oh,
I take it you're not really a fictional detective in a popular series of books written by someone called PJ Fox. I assume you are, in fact, PJ Fox herself, otherwise known as Sophie Beck, born in Hither Green in southeast London in 1984.
She says this with a wry smile.
Yes. Sorry, I...
Look, I work in private education. There's nothing I haven't seen or encountered. But why did you lie?
I didn't want to cause any more ripples, I suppose, Sophie says. It's actually my boyfriend who's the new head teacher, not my brother. And it was me that found the ring in the grounds.
Their wine arrives and Jacinta picks it up immediately and takes a large sip, eyeing Sophie curiously over the rim.
Well, listen, I don't get to chat with detective novelists turned amateur sleuths every day. And sadly, I can't tell you much you don't already know. But when you said they'd found something in the woods behind the college, I did assume that you were going to say something else.
Yes?
Apparently, there's a tunnel,
Jacinta continues,
which runs from the big house where Scarlett Jacques used to live.
I read something about that. It was dug out during the Civil War.
Correct, says Jacinta. And I always wondered when this was all going on. I wondered about the tunnel. I told the police about it and they looked into it, but Scarlett's family had never found the entrance and neither had the family who lived there before them. and before that, the house had lain empty for quite some time. They even got a house historian in to search for it, but nothing. And that was that. But I still think to this day. I mean, that family, the Jacques, they were... I don't know. They were quite the gang of narcissists, all of them.
In what way?
Well, the girl, Scarlett, she wasn't a student at the Maypole at the time of the disappearances, but she was there for the 2 years before that, and she was such a pretty girl. But such a damaged girl, I always thought. She had this way of managing people by making them think she needed them, making them think she was a hopeless mess and that only they could keep her together. But underneath it all, I always felt she knew exactly what she was doing. And the mother, awful woman, all image, no substance. The father I only met once at Scarlett's initial interview. He disappeared halfway through the interview to take a call. He was very distant, cold. The whole family felt like this group of ice floes, just sort of drifting about, never touching. And so, when this couple went missing, and I heard they'd last been seen at the Jacques house, I suppose I wasn't surprised at all. But there was no connection, was there? I mean, according to what I've read, the couple only met the Maypole kids that night. Well, not quite. Remember, Scarlett and the girl were at Manton College together. Yes, but according to the other kids, they didn't know each other all that well. Well, that's not entirely true. There was a girl called Ruby, also a former Maypole girl. She wasn't at the pool party that night, but she told the police that she thought there might have been something more going on between the girls. I can't remember her name. Tallulah. Yes, of course, Tallulah. She thought there was something going on between Scarlett and Tallulah. Apparently, Scarlett was bisexual, and she and Ruby had had a bit of a thing between themselves when they were younger. The owner of a cake shop in Manton, not far from the college, said she'd seen Tallulah in there a few times earlier that year with a girl who matched Scarlett's description. But Scarlett denied it, said there were loads of girls who looked like her at college. Jacinta rolls her eyes and lifts her glass to her mouth, putting it down again before having taken a sip, to say, "And Scarlett's boyfriend Liam, have you met him?" "Yes, yes, I have." Sophie feels herself flush slightly at the mention of his name. Well, he was there that night, and he claims that he'd never met Tallulah before then, but... She sighs. "I'm not so sure. I always thought he was holding something back. Always thought maybe he was protecting Scarlett somehow. Because he was so in love with that girl. So madly, crazily in love with her. And he had his heart well and truly broken when she ended things with him. Even as teachers at the school, we were all aware of it and concerned, you know." "Oh," says Sophie. "When Liam told me about it, he said he was fine about it ending." "Well, he was lying to you. I was there. We all saw him wandering around the college looking like a broken man." Jacinta runs her finger around the base of her wine glass. "You know," she says, "that was probably the worst year of my life. So much stress. I found out my husband had been having an affair that year. We separated, and then he went for a walk one afternoon and never came back. To be fair, we were in utter crisis at the time. We were in the process of divorcing. He was only there at the weekends. So when he didn't come back, at first, I wasn't too worried. I assumed he'd just gone back to his flat without saying goodbye. But then, when he didn't phone to speak to our son that night, or the night after, when he didn't reply to any of my son's text messages or ask about the dog, I reported him missing to the police. They sent dogs into the woods, but they found nothing. And I had to accept, eventually, that he just didn't want to be part of our lives anymore. That he wanted to be gone. To this other woman. Exclusively.
She sighs heavily and then continues.
And then those teenagers went missing and it was all too much. My annus horribilis. The worst year of my life. I knew I had to leave.
Sophie gets back to the cottage a few minutes before 8. Sean has only just returned from work and looks drained as he searches the still unfamiliar kitchen cupboards for a water glass. She comes up behind him and encircles his waist with her arm, burying a kiss into the creased cotton beneath his shoulder blade.
I'm back, she says.
I can tell, he says, not turning to complete the hug. How was town?
It was nice.
She pulls away from him and says, look at my lovely hair. He turns and touches the ends of it, where it still kicks outwards after her blow-dry.
Very pretty, he says distractedly. I'm glad you had a nice day.
Sophie hasn't told him about the real content of her day. She wishes she could share it all with him, but feels very keenly that he will not approve.
I did, she says. It was lovely to get out and about.
He peers at her curiously.
Are you okay? He asks.
Yes, I'm fine.
I mean, with this. With us. With the move. Are you getting on okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's not... I don't know, it's not...
He cuts in.
Are you regretting it? Coming out here with me?
No!
She says forcefully.
No, I'm not regretting it.
She sees his face soften with relief.
Good,
he says.
I knew what I was signing up for, she says. I knew everything. And it's fine, honestly. I just want you to concentrate on your job and not worry about me, please.
He exhales and smiles and pulls her towards him in an embrace laced with regret and guilt and fear. Because despite the words that have just passed between them, they both know, deep down, that this is not going to work. That what brought them together in London, with the romance of separate homes and separate friends and jobs that they both knew how to do without thinking too hard about them, is not here anymore. That they rushed into this in a flurry of sex and summer and the romantic notion of the English countryside, and manicured grounds and foreign princesses, and now they are floundering. Sean's phone chirrups on the counter behind him, and he goes to look at it. He never ignores his phone because he doesn't live with his children, and Sophie entirely understands this.
It's Kerri-Anne, he says. She wants me to come to her apartment. She says it's urgent.
Shall I come too?
She sees indecision pass across his features. He should say no, but in the light of the conversation they've just had, he nods and says,
sure. Of course.
The sky is just growing dark as they crunch across the gravelled path towards the accommodation block. It's the first cold evening of the autumn, and Sophie shivers slightly in a thin cardigan and bare legs. Kerri-Anne is waiting outside the door of her block, her arms folded across her chest. She looks relieved when she sees Sean and Sophie approaching and says,
I'm sorry to disturb you in your free time, I really am. But you need to see this.
She leads them around to the front of the block, where the balconies overlook the woods beyond and where her own large terrace overhangs the spot where they stand, and she points across the flower beds.
I didn't see it. It was Lexi. She just got back from Florida at lunchtime. She was vaping on the terrace, and there it was. She hasn't touched it, thank goodness. I'd already filled her in on all the shenanigans, so she knew what it meant.
Behind the flower beds is a small, straggly area of lawn, then a wide, gravelled pathway, and beyond that a second gateway into the woodlands. But there, tucked away but apparently visible from the balconies overhead, is a piece of cardboard nailed to the bottom of a tree, with the words, "Dig here," written on it in black marker pen, and an arrow pointing to the soil underneath. Chapter 35, September 2018. Noah falls asleep as soon as Kim puts him to bed. He'd been tetchy all evening. Kim can't quite remember what her two were like at this age. Her memory has recalibrated the detail. She knows that one of them used to have tantrums in the supermarket, and she suspects it was Tallulah, but that suspicion has been subverted over the past 15 months, because Kim cannot remember anything bad about Tallulah. She cannot remember beyond Tallulah's upturned face in her bedroom as she painted black liquid wings onto her eyes before the Christmas party at college. The pale luminescence of her skin, the perfect upward slope of her nose, the pink of her rosebud lips, the fragile, barely noticeable beauty that had always felt like a secret just between the two of them. She can't square that calm, glorious girl with the 2-year-old girl screaming in supermarkets. They cannot be the same person. Therefore, she tends to imagine that these things hadn't really happened. Or that it had been Ryan, in fact. Or maybe somebody else's child. Not hers. Not Tallulah. But she has no such ghostly veils across her opinion of her grandson. She loves him, but oh, she finds him so very, very difficult to live with. She had not wanted a third child. She had been offered the opportunity. There'd been a man a year or so after she and Jim split up. A man who said he'd give her a baby and she'd been in her early 30s and Ryan had been about to leave primary school. And it had felt, for a moment, like the right time to do it. But she hadn't been able to face the prospect of the sleepless nights and the worry in the adding of another 18 years onto the journey of motherhood. She'd imagined herself the age she is now, just 40, with 2 grown-up children, and she'd liked the idea of it. So she'd said no to the nice man who'd offered her a baby, and they'd gone the distance as lovers, and then he'd left when he realised he wanted more, and that was that. She had specifically chosen not to have a third child, and now she has one. And he is dark and angry, and she is tired all the time. All the time. But for now he is asleep, and they have crossed the bridge of another day together, and her love for him is as complete as the love she has for the 2 children she gave birth to. Especially now, when he is close but not awake. When she has 12 hours to be herself. She opens a bottle of wine and pours herself a small glass. The cold kiss of it as it hits the bottom of her stomach is immediate and pleasurable. She takes another sip and picks up her phone, about to spend some time mindlessly scrolling through her Facebook feed. But just as her thumb hits the blue icon on her screen, it is obliterated by an incoming phone call. Dom McCoy. She clears her throat and presses answer.
Kim, it's me, Dom. We've had a development. At Maypole House. Are you able to come over?
Kim's breath catches. I just put the baby down. I'm alone. I don't have anyone to ask to sit with him. Can you just tell me? There's a beat of silence. Then he says.
Okay, Kim. Give me 5. 10 minutes. I'll come over. Just stay put.
The 10 minutes turn to 18 minutes before Dom's shadow finally passes across the panes of glass in Kim's front door. She opens the door before he's rung the bell and leads him into the living room. While she's been waiting, she's tipped her wine back into the bottle and put it in the fridge. She's plumped her cushions and put away some of Noah's toys. She's tied her hair back and put some socks on so that Dom won't see her unpolished toenails.
How are you?
Dom begins, taking the blue denim armchair he always takes when he comes to see Kim with updates.
I'm okay, she says.
Tired, you know.
Yes, says Dom. I completely empathise with that.
He doesn't wear a wedding ring anymore. Kim had first noticed this about 6 months ago. And he's lost weight. She stares at him eagerly, willing him to say something good.
Carrie-Anne Mulligan called us about an hour ago. Her daughter saw something in the grounds of the college from her balcony. She went to investigate and found this.
He turns his phone towards her and shows her a photo of what looks like exactly the same cardboard sign that the head teacher's girlfriend had found nailed to her fence the week before.
What?
She asks hoarsely.
What was it?
He turns his phone back to himself and swipes left on the screen before turning it back to her. She stares at the image for a moment. It's a lumpy object in a clear bag with writing on it. It doesn't make any sense.
What is it?
She asks.
Well, says Dom, I was hoping you might be able to tell us that.
She places her fingertips against the screen and pulls the image open. It's a strange metal tool with a bent end and a U-shape cut out of it, almost like a very small garden spade. I don't know what that is. I have no idea. She sees a flash of disappointment pass across Dom's face.
Well, he says, it's gone to forensics, so hopefully they might have some kind of idea what it is. And in the meantime, we're still waiting to hear back from the Prince guys about the ring and the ring box. But I have to be honest, Kim, it's not looking very optimistic there. And the handwriting analysis is back, apparently, so I'll be having a look at that first thing tomorrow. So still lots to chew over.
He smiles at her, and she knows he's trying to sound upbeat, but she also knows that this isn't panning out as he'd hoped it might, because as much as it's Kim whose daughter is missing, she also knows that not being able to solve this case has been deeply upsetting for Dom as well. She musters a smile and says, thanks, Dom. Thank you for everything.
I wish there was more for me to do, he replies. There never seems to be enough for me to do, but this, he says, tucking his phone into his pocket, is better than nothing. Someone knows something, and someone wants us to know what they know. So keep your ear to the ground, Kim. Keep your wits about you. If you hear anything from anyone, if anyone tells you they've seen something strange, let me know immediately, okay?
He glances at her seriously, and she smiles and says, sure. And for a moment, she feels as though she might just open her mouth and add, I have wine. Do you have time? But realizes immediately that of course he doesn't have time, that he's in the middle of doing a job, and that he has a car to drive home and a life to live, children to put to bed, and that he has done what he came here to do, and of course he doesn't want to stay and drink wine with a tired, sad woman. So she gets to her feet too, and sees him to the door.
I'll be in touch again, first thing tomorrow. Take care, Kim.
Yes, she says, clutching the edge of the door, feeling the urgent pull of wanting to be close to another human being, wanting something more than just her and Noah and this house and all these unanswered questions, before closing the door behind him and immediately forcing her fist into her mouth to hold back her tears. Chapter 36, May 2017. Spring wends its way towards summer in a haze of tedious college days and dull nights spent wedged next to Zach on the sofa, the baby monitor blinking on the table at their side. Noah gets to the stage where his head is too big for his body, and they joke about how he looks like a bobblehead and have to prop his huge cranium up with cushions when he falls asleep in the back of the car. The apartment on the Reigate Ring Road falls through when the bank refuses them a mortgage, and Zach goes back to his spreadsheets and his bank statements with an air of dark resentment. It seems that buying a property is the only thing that matters to him now. That being a homeowner at 19 is some kind of badge of honour that will make him feel like a winner. They've taken to having sex on Wednesday afternoons when Zach gets home early, Kim is at work, Ryan is at school, and Noah is having his daily nap. It's the same every time. A practiced series of movements that ends, within roughly 10 minutes, with Zach orgasming silently with his face pressed into a pillow and Tallulah running on tiptoe to the bathroom afterwards and staring at herself in the mirror, wondering who the naked, empty-eyed girl with the blotchy breasts looking back at her is. But she also feels a sense of relief, a sense that it is done, that now she has a week in which her body is her own. The weeks tick by and the days grow longer. Summer exams beckon, and Tallulah spends more of her time at home revising and less sitting on the sofa with Zach, who stalks in and out of their bedroom when she's studying, finding stupid excuses to distract her. At college, she sees Scarlett nearly every day, and they have learned how to ignore each other to the point where Tallulah can sometimes believe that maybe none of it ever happened, that it was all a dream. Scarlett's friends had never accepted her as part of Scarlett's life in the first place, and happily accept that she is no longer there. They wave at her if they pass on campus. They say, "Hi, Lules," and Tallulah says, "Hi," back. But in the canteen at lunchtime, Tallulah sits with the kids from her social care course, or on her own. She and Scarlett have not spoken a word to each other since the Sunday morning when Tallulah arrived to find her with her ex-boyfriend's teeth marks on her neck. Scarlett sent plaintive WhatsApps and snaps for a few days, but Tallulah simply deleted them all immediately and then blocked her. But it doesn't matter how much time passes or how efficiently they have been able to pretend that they don't know each other. The feeling of wanting Scarlett is still as raw, as red, as real as it was when they were together. Tallulah aches, physically, when she thinks about the feel of Scarlett's hands on hers under the table at their secret old lady cake shop. About those Sunday mornings. When she closes her eyes, she gets flashbacks to the smell of the scented candle in Scarlett's bedroom, the heat of Scarlett's mouth on her skin, the flush of her flesh that stayed for hours after she got home. And she wants it all back. But she can't have it because Tallulah is a mother. She has a child, and she has responsibilities, and she cannot hand any of that over to the care of someone who doesn't see that it is wrong to let your ex give you love bites while your current love is on a bike coming to see you. She owes it to Noah to give him stable foundations. And Scarlett is lots of things, but she is not stable. But then one sunny Tuesday morning, as Tallulah pushes Noah to the pond in his buggy with a small plastic bag of dry bread slices tucked into the hood of the pram, she sees a familiar figure across the common. Scarlett is at college all day on Tuesdays. She shouldn't be here. She shouldn't be across the common, staring right at Tallulah. Tallulah panics. For a moment, she thinks she might just turn Noah's buggy 180 degrees and head home. But Scarlett's pace has picked up and she is heading straight towards her now, and Tallulah can see her brow is furrowed in confusion, her gaze oscillating between Tallulah and the buggy. Tallulah lets her head drop into her chest, takes a deep breath and walks to meet Scarlett in the middle of the common.
"Oh my God, is he yours?"
Tallulah nods. "Yes, this is Noah. He's mine." Scarlett stares at her in disbelief. Then she crouches and reaches into the buggy, and for a moment Tallulah's heart starts to race. She thinks maybe Scarlett is going to snatch him, pinch him, hurt him. She pulls the buggy towards herself, but Scarlett is merely greeting Noah.
"Hello, gorgeous,"
she says, rubbing the backs of her fingers against Noah's cheeks. Noah stares at her, wide-eyed but not disturbed. Scarlett's gaze tips up to Tallulah.
"Oh my God," she says. "He's so beautiful."
"Thanks." Scarlett issues a nervous laugh.
"God, Lules, you're a mummy."
Tallulah sighs and nods.
"Why didn't you fucking tell me?"
"Could you not?" Tallulah begins, hating herself for saying it, but needing to say it because the words physically hurt when she's in front of her baby.
"Could you not swear? Do you mind?"
Scarlett muzzles herself with both her hands.
"Shit,"
she says.
"I'm sorry."
"It's fine, it's just he's at that age, you know, when he's starting to try and talk, and I couldn't deal with it if that was his first word, you know." Scarlett nods and smiles.
"God, yes, of course."
She brings herself back to standing and puts her hands in the pockets of a weird patchwork blouson jacket. Her hair is short and messy, and she has an outbreak of spots around her mouth. But she still takes Tallulah's breath away.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
she asks again. Tallulah shrugs.
"I don't really know."
"And so this is why you're stuck with that loser. I finally understand."
Tallulah feels her defences rise.
"He's not a loser."
Scarlett shrugs. "Whatever." They stand and stare at each other for a moment. Noah starts to moan a little and kick his feet.
"I'm taking him to the pond,"
Tallulah says. She doesn't add, "Do you want to come?" But Scarlett follows her anyway.
"I can't believe you, Lules. You binned me off because I kissed my ex, and all the while, you've got a secret fucking baby."
Tallulah throws her a stern look, and Scarlett says,
"God, sorry, yes. But I just can't even. I mean, no one at college knows you've got a baby. I don't get it. Why wouldn't you mention it?"
"That's not true, actually. There are plenty of people at college who know I've got a baby. Just not people you would ever think about talking to."
Scarlett tuts and says,
"Oh, right, yeah. Make me out to be the villain here. It's always me, isn't it? Never anyone else. And who cares anyway? The deal here is that you kept this, like, huge secret from me, and I never kept anything from you. Not ever. I was always totally honest with you, even that last Sunday. I could have kicked Liam out and made sure your paths didn't cross, but I didn't. Because even though what I did was a bit suspect, I didn't want to deceive you.
I couldn't lie to you.
I'm incapable of lying, basically. That's one of my biggest problems. So, wow, I mean this."
She gestures at the buggy.
"I mean just wow."
Tallulah puts the brake on the buggy as they reach the edge of the pond and leans down to undo Noah's straps before lifting him out.
"It's not the same thing,"
she replies tersely.
"Not the same thing at all."
She takes a slice of the stale bread from the bag and tears a bit off. Noah grabs it from her hand and tries to throw it into the pond, but it drops at Scarlett's feet. Scarlett picks it up and hands it back to him and says,
"Try again, buddy."
She puts her hand over his and gently guides his arm into a proper throw and cheers when the bread hits the surface of the pond.
"High five!"
she says, touching her hand against his as he stares at her in wonder.
"You know, I bloody love babies. Lula, I even told you that I love babies. I just don't get any of this."
Tallulah tears off another piece of bread and guides it into Noah's hand.
"Yes," she says. "I should have told you. You're right. But I didn't because I wanted you."
She pauses to find words that won't make her sound as bad as she feels.
"I wanted you to think I was like you. You know, a free spirit."
"But you've got a bloody boyfriend. How less free can you possibly be than that?"
"Yes, but a boyfriend isn't permanent. A child is permanent. Wherever I go, he goes. Whatever I'm doing, I'm his mother. 24/7. For the rest of my life, and it's a lot, you know?"
"Fuck, Lula. Life is a lot. All of it is a lot. You and me, we had this thing, this amazing, amazing thing that I thought was the most important thing that had ever happened to me. From minute one, that day on the bus, I saw you and I knew everything that was going to happen. That you and I were destined to be together. And then we were. And you made me so
She glances at Noah and pauses.
"You made me so happy.
And I know what I did with Liam was wrong. But I suppose I just thought that as long as you had Zach in your life, as long as you made a secret out of you and me,"
she gestures between them with her hand,
"then we weren't real."
They both clap then, as Noah's next attempt to throw bread lands successfully and a group of ducks draws quickly towards it. Scarlett puts out her hand and cups the back of Noah's head.
"God," she says. "He's so precious. He's so, so precious."
Tallulah feels something in her gut a kick of pleasure, but also of fear. She pulls Noah slightly closer to her body, and Scarlett lets her hand drop from his head.
You know, she says, we could do this. We could! I feel like you think I'm some kind of beautiful idiot, you know? And I know I do play up to that. I do. People are easier to deal with if they underestimate you. But I'm not an idiot, Lules. I've lived a life. Things have happened. Bad things. I've grown and learned and matured. I could totally do the baby thing. With you. But the question is, are you ready to be honest about us?
Tallulah glances at her questioningly.
You mean tell people?
Scarlett nods. Tallulah turns her gaze back to the water, to the bowed heads of the ducks bobbing for the wet bread. She tries to picture herself telling various people in her life. Her mother would be fine. Ryan would be surprised, but fine. Pretty much everyone she knows at college would be fine. There's only one person she can't ever imagine telling.
I can never tell Zach, she says. He'd kill me.
Kill you? Scarlett's eyes are wide.
Yes. He'd kill me. Are you serious?
Tallulah closes her eyes. She pictures his face, the way his jaw clenches together when he's displeased about something, the way his fist comes down upon inanimate objects when he's annoyed, the flare of his nostrils, the entitled tilt of his chin as he surveys the object of his displeasure. And she remembers the tightness of his hands around her arms when she told him that she didn't have time for him, and imagines that amplified tenfold if she told him that she was leaving him for a girl. Zach isn't liberal. He has no time for political correctness. He is his mother's son, small-minded, self-absorbed, inward-thinking, a little bit racist, a little bit homophobic, a little bit misogynistic. All those things that don't matter when you're 14 and in love, but start to sprout insidiously to the surface over the years it takes you to go from child to adult. And even now, it's not blatant, but she knows him well enough to know that it's there. And she knows him well enough to know that he would be humiliated if he found out about her affair with Scarlett, and that that humiliation would spill over into anger, and that he is strong, and he is already only one flash away from hurting her. Constantly.
Yes,
she replies, opening her eyes.
Yes, I think he would.
Oh my God, Lula.
Has he ever hit you?
She shakes her head.
Not really.
Not really?
No, he hasn't.
Scarlett laces her fingers into her short hair and tugs at it, takes a couple of paces away and then paces back again.
Lula, God, I mean, this is bad. Do you even love him? I used to.
But now? She shrugs and sniffs.
No,
she says quietly.
Not anymore. Not really.
And do you want to spend the rest of your life with him? She shakes her head hard. She can feel tears coming and she doesn't want them.
No,
she says, her voice cracking.
No, I don't.
Then fuck Tallulah. You need to sort this out. You need to get rid of him. Because you can't live your life like this. You can't live your life being scared.
But how do I get rid of him?
Tallulah says.
How?
Part 3. Chapter 37. May 2017. The following afternoon, when she gets home from college, Tallulah takes Noah for a walk around the village at around the time that she would normally put him down for his afternoon nap and have sex with Zach. She turns her phone to silent and puts in her earbuds, the music turned up loud, refusing to allow the image of Zach getting back from work to an empty house to taint her thoughts. She pushes the buggy into the co-op and scopes the shop for Keziah. She spies her in the bakery aisle, stacking the shelves with self-raising flour.
Hiya.
She says. Keziah turns round. She glances at Tallulah and then into the buggy. When she sees Noah, she claps her hands to her mouth and makes a muffled squeaking noise.
Oh my God.
She takes her hands from her mouth.
Oh my God, Lula, he's beautiful. He's so beautiful.
Tallulah smiles and feels the swirl in her gut she always gets when someone tells her that her son is beautiful.
Thank you, she says. Sorry he's not awake, but I said I'd bring him in to show you.
How old is he now?
11 months.
Oh my God, where did the time go? Feels like it was only about 5 minutes ago you were just pregnant.
Tallulah smiles again. How's Zach?
Oh, he's fine, you know.
Still together?
Yeah, just about.
She laughs dryly. It's tough with a baby, isn't it?
Yeah,
she replies.
It has its moments. Especially living together. Actually, I was going to say, remember you talked about getting together with the others from school?
Yeah,
Kaziah's face lights up.
Oh, definitely. We're going out tomorrow as it happens, just to the Ducks. Want to come?
Yes, please.
Tallulah says brightly, feeling the plan fall into place.
That'd be great. What time?
7-ish, or whenever you can get away, really. What with the bubba and everything.
Kaziah makes that pained face again, the face she makes every time she looks at Noah, almost as if his beauty is a terrible blight of some kind.
Great, says Tallulah. I'll see you then.
She pushes the buggy back out of the shop and then walks for an hour, up to the other end of the village, where the estate is, and to the common around the back lanes. She times her walk so that she gets back half an hour before her mother and Ryan return, long enough for the argument to play itself out. As she approaches the cul-de-sac, her heart races with anticipation. She turns her key in the lock and pushes open the door.
Hello,
she calls out. Noah is still asleep and she leaves him in his buggy in the hallway and peers around the living room door. Zach sits on the sofa, his phone in his hand. He looks up at her darkly.
Where the fuck have you been?
She closes the door behind her.
Took Noah out for a walk. It was too nice to stay in, and I've done all my revision.
I've called you like 100 times. Why didn't you fucking answer?
She pulls her phone from the pocket of her hoodie and glances at it.
Oh,
she says.
Shit, sorry, it was on silent.
Shit, sorry, it was on silent,
he mimics her.
What sort of mother goes out without telling anyone and leaves their phone on silent?
Me, I guess.
Her tone is glib, but beneath her ribcage, her heart is hammering.
I literally had no idea where you both were. You could have been dead for all I know.
Well, we're not, so it's fine.
He shakes his head.
Unbelievable,
he says.
Totally unbelievable. And not only that, but it's Wednesday. You know, our Wednesday.
Oh, shit,
she says.
God, I forgot. I'm really sorry.
No, you're not. You're not fucking sorry. I can tell.
I am, honestly. I just finished my revision and it was so gorgeous out. And Noah was getting scratchy for his nap. And I just thought how nice it would be to get out and about for a while. And I totally forgot it was Wednesday.
You forgot it was Wednesday?
He groans and rolls his eyes.
And here we go again. Just when I thought we were finally getting somewhere, that you were finally taking this seriously. I should have guessed. This is just like a joke to you, isn't it? This.
He gestures between the two of them. Me, you, Noah. Just a game.
You know, I sometimes feel like if something better came along, you'd just walk away from Noah and me. You know, like you don't give a shit about anyone apart from yourself.
Tallulah swallows down a burst of rage. The idea of walking away from Noah is monstrous, unimaginable. She tips her head slightly and says,
Whatever.
Whatever?
Yes, whatever. You've clearly made your mind up about me and what sort of person I am and what I want and don't want. I can't be bothered arguing with you.
She sighs.
I'm going to get myself a cup of tea,
she says, turning towards the kitchen.
Want anything?
He shakes his head firmly, and she sees a muscle in his cheek pulsing with anger.
Oh,
she calls back to him. By the way, I bumped into Keziah just now. Remember Keziah, who I went to primary school with? She's invited me to a girls' night, a reunion thing at the Ducks tomorrow night. You're all right staying in with Noah, aren't you?
There's a dull silence from the living room, and Tallulah holds her breath. A moment later, Zack is in the doorway of the kitchen, flexing and unflexing his fists.
Sorry?
He says.
Keziah who?
Keziah Whitmore. I went to primary school with her. She works at the co-op now.
Right. So let me get this straight. After knowing you for nearly 5 years, I've never heard of this person before, and now you're just going for drinks.
Yes, she says, closing the fridge door. Tomorrow night.
And how are you going to pay for that?
She shrugs. I don't know. Mum will probably let me have some money.
So here's me, working my fucking self to death, day in, day out. Never spend a penny on anything. Not a fucking penny. Single-handedly trying to get us a place to live, and you're just going to the pub with some slag called Keziah, who I've never even fucking heard of.
I don't ask you to work so hard, she replies evenly. I don't expect you not to spend any money on anything. I don't tell you you can't go out, and frankly, I don't even want us to buy a flat. I like living here with Mum.
She glances at him briefly. She can see the clenched jaws start to grind.
I'm sorry?
I don't want to move out. I want to stay here with Mum.
He grunts.
Christ, you are such a fucking child, Tallulah. You still haven't grown up, have you? You still think life's all swanning about, doing what you like, going to the pub, hanging out with Mummy? Well, it's not. We have a child. We have responsibilities. We're not kids anymore, Tallulah. It's time to grow the fuck up.
He looms over her now, and she can feel the heat of his breath on her face.
I think you should move out, she says.
A taut silence follows.
What?
I think we should split up. I don't want to be with you anymore.
Tallulah's gaze stays on the floor, but she can feel Zack's rage coalescing in the air around her. Another drawn-out silence follows, and Tallulah waits. Waits to be hit. Waits to be screamed at. Waits for the anger that exists so close to the tight seams of Zack's psyche finally to burst through. But it doesn't. After a few seconds, she feels his presence soften and shrink, sees his shoulders slope, and then he is gone. She follows him into the hallway. He is leaning over Noah's sleeping form in his buggy and whispering to him. Tallulah feels a terrible chill run through all of her. She moves closer and watches, her body primed and ready to do whatever it takes to protect Noah from Zack. She hears the click of the safety harness being unclipped and watches as Zack carefully plucks Noah from his buggy and lifts him towards his shoulder. Noah doesn't stir. He is heavy with sleep. His big head flops gently into the crook of Zack's neck, and Zack kisses him softly on his crown. His eyes meet Tallulah's over the top of their child's head, and he says in a voice hard with resolve,
I am not going anywhere, Tallulah. I'm not going fucking anywhere.
Chapter 38, September 2018. Sophie sits at her desk in the hallway of the cottage by the front door. The weird burning petrol smell in the hallway that's been there since they moved in has finally started to fade, and she's moved her work area here where the window overlooks the college campus, so she can watch the comings and goings in the school grounds. Sean told her last night what the detectives had found buried in the flower bed outside the accommodation block. He said it was a lever of some kind, a piece of metal with a handle and a bent tip. Very old, apparently. Nobody knows what it is or why it was buried there, or by whom. It's a total mystery. But there's another mystery preying on Sophie's mind. The cardboard sign had been spotted by Lexi Mulligan, Carrie Ann's daughter, just hours after she returned home from a trip to Florida. She claims to have seen it while standing on her mother's terrace, vaping. Earlier today, Sophie had gone for a walk around the accommodation block, and stared upwards to Carrie-Anne Mulligan's terrace and felt a jolt in the pit of her stomach at the stark realisation
that the terrace was far too low down to see across the flower bed to the spot where the cardboard sign had been left, and she'd known immediately that, for some reason, Lexi had been lying. Sophie flips open the lid of her laptop now and Googles Lexi Mulligan. She clicks the link to her Instagram account, which is called Lexi Goes. Lexi looks very different in her photos to how she looks in real life. In real life, she is attractive, but has a certain flatness to her features, a lack of delicacy. But in these shots, she looks like a model. There she is in a black satin dressing gown printed with roses, cross-legged and sipping a cocktail on her Florida balcony with the backdrop of a heart-shaped swimming pool. The accompanying text is a thinly veiled promotion for the hotel and is full of hashtags relating to the hotel and its parent company. Sophie glances at the top of the page and sees that Lexi has 72,000 followers. She assumes that the hotel was a freebie as recompense for the publicity, and she assumes that with that many followers, Sophie herself has 812, Lexi must get lots of freebies and lots of payouts from the businesses she promotes. And she wonders why a grown woman with what looks like a great career is still living with her mum in a tiny flat in a boarding school in Surrey. As she thinks this, she glances again through the window and sees Lexi herself striding across the campus. She's wearing patterned leggings and a black hoodie, and her hair is in two plaits. She has a carrier bag that looks like the ones they give you at the co-op, and she looks a million miles from the girl in the Instagram posts. Sophie watches her as she heads towards the accommodation block. A few minutes later, she sees the door open onto Kerri-Anne's terrace, and Lexi appears with a mug of tea. She gazes out across the campus and into the woods beyond for a moment, before turning and heading back indoors. For some reason, there's something unsettling about the way she does this. Something strangely forensic. Sophie glances down at Lexi's Instagram feed again and scrolls downwards and downwards through Cuba, Colombia, Quebec, St. Bart's, Copenhagen, Belfast, the Hebrides, Beijing, Nepal, Liverpool, Moscow. Her head spins with the breadth of Lexi's travelling. She keeps scrolling until she gets to something more familiar. It's Lexi in front of the beautiful main doors to the school. Behind her, the light from the stained glass in the reception area falls into coloured puddles on the tiled floor. She's wearing an ankle-length fake fur coat and a green woolen hat with a furry bobble. By her side is a pair of huge suitcases. The caption says, "Home sweet home." Sophie does a double take. She scrolls through the comments and sees that Lexi's followers are under the impression that these are the doors to her house, that this is her home. And Lexi does nothing to correct these misapprehensions. She lets her followers believe that, yes, this is where she lives. Sophie sees a comment from Kerri-Anne Mulligan. "And your mummy is so happy to have you back." She blinks. Kerri-Anne appears to be supporting the illusion that Lexi lives in a Georgian mansion. She's about to start scrolling deeper into Lexi's feed when she hears a knock at the back door. She closes her laptop and walks through the cottage. She calls out hello.
"Hi, Sophie. It's me, Liam."
Sophie's breath catches.
"Oh," she says. "Hi, just 1 minute."
She checks her reflection in the wall mirror and pulls her hair away from her face. Then she opens the door and greets Liam with a smile. He stands before her, clutching a novel in his hands. She glances down and sees that it is her book, the first of the series, the one she wrote when she was still a teaching assistant, the one she had no idea anyone would ever actually read. And now, here it is, being held in the good, strong hands of a handsome boy called Liam, and her words, she realises with a jolt, have been inside his head.
"I'm really sorry to disturb you," Liam says, breaking into her train of thought. "But I finished your book last night, and I just loved it. I mean, I really, really loved it. And I just wondered if you had a minute. I'd love to ask you a question about it, but I can come back another time if you're busy."
She stares at him for a second, then she shakes her head a little and says,
"Oh, thank you. I wasn't expecting, I mean,
Yes, sorry. Please, come in.
He follows her into the kitchen and pats the spine of her book against the palm of his free hand a couple of times.
I won't keep you. I just, But your book, there's something I wanted to ask you. Susie Beats, is she you?
Sophie blinks. It's not the question she was expecting.
I mean, he continues, you have the same initials, and she's blonde, and in her 30s, and comes from South London, and used to be a school teacher.
No, she says. No, she's not me. She's more like a really good friend, or the sister I never had. It's a stock answer, but she continues. If anything, Tiger has more of my personality traits and opinions in him.
Really? Says Liam, his face lighting up. Wow, that's so interesting. Because, I don't know, I felt like I was reading about you when I pictured everything in my head. I just saw you doing everything that Susie does. Even down to your shoes.
My shoes? They both glance down at her feet. She's wearing white trainers, as she nearly always does.
I mean, you never describe her shoes, but I pictured her in white trainers, because that's what you wear.
Sophie doesn't quite know how to respond.
Do I not describe her shoes?
She asks. Liam shakes his head. No, never.
Well,
she says slightly breathlessly. Thank you for pointing that out. Next time I describe what she's wearing, I will put in a description of her shoes, just for you.
Seriously?
He says. Yes, seriously.
Wow. And which book would that be in? Are you writing a new one?
She glances behind her towards her laptop on the desk in the hallway. Well, technically, yes, but I haven't written a word since I moved here, to be truthful, despite my best intentions.
Writer's block.
Well, no, not strictly. Writer's block is a serious psychological malaise. It can last for years, forever in some particularly tragic cases.
So why do you think you haven't been able to write?
Oh, she says, lots of reasons. But mainly, I think, because of finding that ring and now all the other stuff going on.
Liam nods. It's all a bit freaky, isn't it?
He taps her book against the palm of his other hand again and steps from one foot to another. He seems a little anxious.
I guess it'll all become clear eventually. I wonder what they'll uncover next. Maybe there's someone out there, as I'm talking to you, burying another little surprise for someone to uncover.
Like Easter eggs?
Yes, he says. I suppose they are. I just...
He stops tapping the book and rubs the back of his neck with his free hand.
I just don't get it. I don't get any of it. If someone knows what happened to those kids, then why the hell don't they just go to the police and tell them?
Because maybe they had something to do with it? She sees him shudder slightly.
Freaks me out, he says. Really freaks me out. Anyway.
He appears to reset himself.
I better let you get on. I just wanted to ask you that. About Susie Beats. About the shoes.
He taps the book one more time against his hand and then turns and heads towards the back door. After he's gone, Sophie goes back to her desk and sits for a while, imagining handsome Liam alone in his room, reading her book. She tries to remember the content of the book, but can't. She goes to her bedroom to find the packing box that has her PJ Fox books in it. She slices through the tape and burrows through the contents until she finds the one she's looking for, the first in the series. Perched on the edge of the bed, she flicks through the pages, skimming them with her eyes. And that's when she sees it. The thing that's been hovering in her subconscious since the day she arrived. She flattens the two sides of the book and she reads. Susie opened the creaky gate and peered up and down the high street. It was just getting dark and the wet pavements were glowing warm amber in the streetlight. She pulled the sides of her furry coat together across her body and was about to head back out into the night when she saw something from the corner of her eye. In the flower bed to her left, it was a flap of cardboard nailed to the wooden fence.
In black marker, someone had scribbled the words, "Dig here," with an arrow pointing downwards into the soil. Chapter 39, May 2017.